everybody, and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. My name is Bina 007, and I am joined by...
Hey, this is Zach, also known as Alias on the internet.
And we are here today to talk about Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, Clara and the Sun. Our discussion will be full of spoilers of this amazing, provocative book. We may refer to earlier books like Never Let Me Go or Remains of the Day, so please make sure you've read the book to avoid spoilers, or maybe you want to listen to it, and this will provide a teaser for some of the themes that are in this amazing novel. So first of all, Zach, have you read other Ishiguro books? Were you excited this was coming out, or is this something that you just pulled off the bookshelf and went for?
No, this is actually my first one. This is my first Ishiguro novel. I was told about by my mom, actually. She recommended it. I don't think she'd actually read any of them before, but she just heard of it because she's just up on what new books are coming out. But yeah, this is my first one, so I haven't read The Remains of the Day or Never Let Me Go yet. So feel free to spoil those if you want to. I personally don't mind, and to make connections. I'm actually interested in that, but I haven't read those, but this is my first and I loved it so much. I've already read another one of his books. I've read The Buried Giants, and I'll probably go and read those books and a bunch of
other wonderful ones
because of how much I liked it. So yeah, it is my first, but I'm very much a fan now after reading it.
And how many Kootings machines out of five would you give this novel?
I'm going to give it five. There are very rare books where I am genuinely, truly like engaged to the point where it becomes a page turner. That doesn't happen to me very often. I try to read a lot of books, but for most, there is that element of like, I enjoy them as a totality, but I don't find them on a page like to page like super engrossing. And this was a case where it was. And I think a big reason for that is that I think Clara as a POV was just so unique to me. It was so interesting to see how she viewed the world. And I think that added so much to what otherwise I think, you know, there's many interesting elements to the setting that he's presenting here, but just the way that she views all of it adds so much texture to it that I think it elevated everything about the story, the characters, and the world that was presented.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I would say I'm far Kootings machines at five Kootings machines out of five. And again, there are many movies and books that I love and watch and watch and watch, but maybe there are small things I would change or improve on. But with Clara, I think it's a relatively short novel, but so full of characters who I feel will live with me forever and questions that I feel are so resonant that I can just see me going back and back to it. And kind of at the sentence level, I wouldn't change a single thing. I think it's just beautifully formed. So I feel this is the work of an author, a sort of a Nobel Prize winning author who is just working in his prime and just with such finesse and elegance and nuance that it's just a pleasure to be in his book. And I've spoken to a few friends of mine who aren't necessarily the biggest book readers in the world. And, you know, they've all said it just gripped me and I had to finish it. So it feels like a common experience, which is great.
Yeah, I think part of why it feels that way to me is that, unlike a lot of authors, I think, I feel like he doesn't feel the need to explain himself too much in the writing. Like, I don't feel like he needs to justify anything that appears in the story. I think, and especially when you're engaging in something like this, which I think qualifies as science fiction, I think there's a lot of effort to try to, like, explain details. Like, all right, we have a few elements in this that are unique. Like, we have, of course, we have AI as Clara herself is. We have this notion of being lifted, this idea that certain kids have genetic augmentation or genetic editing, essentially, to be predisposed to be smarter, I guess, or just more capable in other ways. And those ideas never feel like they need to be spelled out. They're just strictly tools, I guess, in the narrative to help you understand the characters and where they're at. And I think a lot of, especially genre fiction, gets bogged down in trying to explain its world to you. And here it just presents itself very naturally. And I think that just speaks to a confidence on the part of the author that I generally think makes for better writing.
So do you find yourself drawn to science fiction novels in general? Would you classify this as a sci-fi novel?
The answer to the first thing, yeah, I love science fiction. I think science fiction novels is an interesting territory because I think compared to its partner fantasy, you know, they're typically grouped together. I don't think it's a popular novel genre, really. I don't think many people actually read too many science fiction novels. They watch science fiction movies or they watch science fiction TV shows. But I think the science fiction genre has not gotten a lot of love, especially recently. So this is an interesting case, right? And it's actually interesting. I haven't read too much of like reviews and stuff of this, and I'm curious if you have, and interviews with the author and stuff, and like how they describe it. But it's that weird territory, like that people do, where it's like, is this literary fiction? Is this genre fiction? How does it qualify? And I think this book, I've vaguely seen it described as like a gender bending, or genre bending, sorry, not gender bending, a genre bending thing where it like goes through a bunch of different genres. Like it's literary, but it's also got these genre elements, like that's exciting. And I just think it's odd maybe sometimes where we feel the need to make that distinction. Like if something,
I think it's really weird because I do think this is a sort of near future. We can argue whether it's dystopian sci-fi book 100%. And yet because it's written by Kazuo Ishiguro,
right.
You know, he's knighted in England. I think he's some kind of chevalier in France. He's got the highest orders in Japan where he was born. Mm-hmm. He's Nobel Prize winning. So somehow, you know, reading reviews of this in the New York Review of Books and the London Review of Books, and it's kind of like people don't mention it. It becomes almost philosophy. It's an inquiry. And I think it's kind mm-hmm. of sniffy. Like, I think this is properly, I mean, it's near future. And I think, you know, a lot of concepts in it, why it resonates is because they are either here now, but not quite fully embedded in society. But
right.
He's definitely in that genre, as is Never Let Me Go.
Sure. I think the reason for that is that among the readership maybe of his books, like describing this bluntly as science fiction would be like a dirty word to some of them, perhaps, like, oh no, it's not one of those books, you know? I think that's just the weird thing about both the marketing of books, but also the way that people look at them. Mm. That I think, I don't know. It's not necessarily, I mean, I don't blame him. And I think he probably, if he was describing it again, I don't know. I haven't actually heard him speak at all. And I probably will check out some of his interviews at some point, but I think he would, you know, describe this as science fiction. I think it totally fits those terms. And I think that he'd be able to say that.
Yeah. And I think the thing about Kazuo Ishiguro is he's incredibly articulate about his own work, very humble about it, but very articulate. Okay. It is worth for those listening checking out his interviews. There's a really nice one on NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross, which is kind of badged as a PR one for Clara and the Sun, but you know, he talks about his life and his work. And there's a really good one on the Bookworm podcast, which they did a two-part, actually. They did one which was all compilations of him talking about previous works on Bookworm, and then the current one on Clara and the Sun, where he really goes into what he thinks the themes are. So where I think it gets really fascinating, and we can get into it in our discussion of this novel, is there are lots of, it's set in a near future where there are artificial friends who are sort of artificial intelligence dolls that people can buy to keep their children company. All learning is remote learning. So kids need help with socialization, which is primarily why you buy these dolls if you can afford to. It's also a world with genetic engineering. So as Zach said, people can be, parents have to make the choice. It's not done in utero. It's done maybe at a prepubescent age or at a pubescent age where you as a parent decide whether you're going to have your child lifted. But there can be consequences to that. So if they're lifted, it's great and they're going to be super intelligent and have the best jobs. But there are potential physical side effects, like it might not work. So you have to take that chance with your child. It's also a world in which advanced robotics and advanced intelligence means that a lot of work, not just blue collar work, but white collar work, has been substituted by artificial intelligence or robots. So lots of, you know, college educated white collar workers are no longer in jobs, and some may or may not be accepting that well or not well. So it speaks to kind of the idea of universal benefit, Yang Gang fans out there. So there's a lot of ideas that are kind of floating around. But I think what Ish says in a lot of his interviews is, despite all these kind of like sci-fi near future ideas, he's really just discussing what he always discusses with what it means to be lonely, what it means to love somebody, what it means to sacrifice for them, the idea of memory, and can love carry over in this case? If you loved someone and you had a near perfect AI replicant, would you love them too, I guess? So I think for Ish, it would be, he wouldn't be ashamed to call it sci-fi, but he'd also say it's just about the basic human stuff, about loneliness and memory and love, maybe.
Oh, it definitely is. And I think, yeah, it's that it's I don't want to get too much down the rabbit hole of like that comparison between genre and literary. But I think that the hope is that you don't have that assumption that something that is ostensibly a genre book would not be capable of exploring themes like that. Exactly. But yeah, it's silly. But yeah, it is certainly about those things. And I think that is also that is actually the main reason why this is a special book. It's not because it has cool sci-fi elements to it. While those are certainly fun, I think that the notion of Clara, as I was saying, being an AI and someone with a fresh perspective on the world is what helps bring those themes into sharper focus. I think that's the main reason why it's cool that she has that perspective. It's not just because it's interesting to explore the idea of AI. I think that helps us see them more clearly, because I think when we're just living our life as humans who have these situations and this baggage, I think we can't see the way that we look at each other in that way. And that's just why, again, yeah, why the POV helps so much.
Okay, well, let's get into some of the topics and the ideas in this book. So let's start with Clara herself. So the idea that there is an affordable, lifelike AI that doesn't age and comes in various iterations. So Clara is, I think she's a second gen, and there's already third gen models on the market. And the idea of Clara as a POV, for me, I've read and seen, obviously, sci-fi movies where the AI is meant to be the outsider who gives us a perspective. I suppose you could have alien movies in that genre, like E.T., right? Mm-hmm. Gives us a fresh perspective. But to me, Clara was just the most sympathetic character in this book. And it really made me question what I think of as a character. And, you know, Ish has said that all characters are fake, right? So the idea that he finds it surprising that we're all so surprised that we're feeling sympathetic towards Clara. It's like, but all the characters are fake creations in my memory. So if one's an AI and one's a human, does it really matter? I think he finds it quite surprising, but I think it's actually an achievement, because in some respects, she is quite childlike and quite naive in some respects. But it's never cloying. I find her such a wonderful character. I really do.
Yeah, it's really remarkable to me that the first, I want to say, 60 pages of the book, we're just with Clara in the store looking out a window with such a limited a limited view on the world is so engaging. Like, how is he able to pull that off, where just this idea of being stuck in a place and having like this view of this one building across the street and just the places where they are in the store, how is that so appealing? And I think to me, like, it's just that she, as a character, you get the stakes of her situation immediately, where you get this constant tension of like, will she be, first of all, will she be bought by anyone? And what happens if she's not? Like, that's a fear that immediately settles in your mind. And then when Josie shows up and presents that particular option that she finds so appealing, you get the fear of, will she end up with Josie? Like, there's just, I think that's the thing that, again, I don't want to like paint a broad brush on a ton of books, but I don't think they're always as good at like immediately establishing those stakes and that tension and the thing that the character wants. And I think that's why she pops out of the book so much, even as a character that is not human in that sense. You feel that human desire to get that thing,
to be loved, to be wanted, to be part of a family. And I think the store manager is lovely, this very sympathetic store manager who warns Clara. She notices how special Clara is. Clara is very good at observing, very, very good at observing small details. And Josie, this little girl, presses her face up against the window and says to Clara, I'm going to come and buy you. You're the one for me. And the store manager says, don't get your hopes up, because sometimes kids, they say that, but they don't come back, or they find something else they want. And it's just heartbreaking. The other thing I find really moving in that opening 60 pages or so is to explain to the listener, if you haven't read it, that Clara is solar powered. And she has obviously a very special relationship to the sun. She thinks as the sun is the kind of the origin of all things good and wholesome and healthy and wellness, I guess, in the modern word. So just seeing Clara see the sunlight fall across a skyscraper opposite the store, her intense reactions to that, I think, are very moving and resonant. You know, a lot of us have just been maybe working from home for a year, stuck in our own place. But seeing how this little girl, this fake little girl, can take such wonder in the normal rhythms of every day and not feel trapped or claustrophobic by them, I thought was almost inspiring. And kind of spookily resonant, because Kazuo Ishiguro says he wrote this well before the pandemic. And yet something about her trapped in that store window or moving around in the store just seemed so resonant to me.
Yeah. Yeah, just to speak on the sun aspect for a second, that to me is actually one of the most brilliant decisions that he made in the story, because it adds an aspect to her as an AI that I don't think that we see very often, where, you know, I think AI, while they can have that emotional element to them, they're typically presented as mostly a logical entity that riddles things out in that way. And this is the one illogical thing about Clara, is that she has this absolute belief in the sun as this sort of subject of faith, which we can get into more about how that actually impacts the rest of the novel. But like, she has absolute belief in the sun to a degree that it can take actions that are not logical. When she's in the store, she sees it as she believes. She sees it bring a homeless man and his dog back from the dead. And she, from that point, draws the conclusion that the sun is able to essentially resurrect people or heal people. And that just makes her so, I don't know, it adds another dimension to her character in a way that I don't think is typically given to this kind of character.
It's a touching faith, isn't it? And the way in which she speaks to the sun when she's imploring the sun to heal Josie is so, how, you know, coming from a sort of Catholic Christian sort of perspective, it's exactly those same cadences where it's total self-abnegation. Like, I have no right to ask you this. I am but nothing. I cannot understand your inner workings. But if you should choose to bestow your grace upon Josie, i.e. sunshine, it's so touching. And what's amazing to me is sometimes when you read novels or just any popular culture, it can be quite sneering towards religion. And there's a way in which this could have become almost mocking, because she is quite naive. And yet it's actually strangely respectful of her and her faith. Like, the author always knows that it's hopeless, that this isn't how Josie is or isn't going to get well. Mm-hmm. And yet it's so respectful and so understanding and empathetic to her love and her desire to help her friend.
I would go so far as to say the book itself does not explicitly make a statement about whether or not the sun actually, you know, maybe the sun did heal Josie at the end. I don't think the book rules either way in a definitive way. So it's possible, like, maybe at least it doesn't go so far as to say poor deluded Clara, you know, she hoped this would happen, and it doesn't. Like, you just don't know for sure, which I think is a good idea too.
And in a sense, all that's important is that Josie does get well and Clara does believe it, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Other topics: predicting at-home learning and resocialization. Yeah. So one of the things I find phenomenal if you read this book is the idea that all the kids are basically at home learning on iPads or modernistic version of iPads, and so are losing touch with kids, and the richer ones can have artificial friends to help them with this socialization. And that as they prepare to go off to college, the lucky ones who have been lifted, their parents have to arrange these really awkward kind of like fake, almost like birthday parties would be nowadays, where you get a whole bunch of kids together so that the kids can learn to socialize. And everyone who I know who's read this, who's a parent, has been like, did he know what the pandemic was gonna bring? But how did you find that, like, that whole concept of learning remotely? Is this the future?
Well, of course, it has that extra degree of resonance to it, given that that's kind of what our life has been, especially the life of kids has been, for the past year. So it is fairly, you know, it's great for him that he was able to, I guess, predict that, because it has that level of resonance to people who are reading the novel now. But yeah, I hope that's not the future, because I think that, and I think to a degree that we're going to see this, I think that it's just not the best way for kids to grow up, to have to live in these siloed ways. And have to deal with it. And I think for some kids it works. I think for some kids they need it, and for some kids it can be the best way to get them in a position where they can take that next step. But being the norm, I think would only be a bad thing. I think that's my stance on it. And I think that is how it is presented in the book. I think it has this texture of it of, like, just the the way that kids interact with each other, there is this sort of inauthenticity to it, that it feels like, it just feels wrong to you. It also feels wrong to Clara, so that might be why. But yeah, just the way that the kids behave with each other is not good.
It really resonated with me that they have this birthday party, well, not this, but this kind of fake social gathering. And all the kids there, bar one, have been lifted. So they are the ones whose parents have chosen to have them genetically modified. They're going to all go to university and have bright, great futures. And they're very conscious of this. And then Clara's best friend is also invited, her next door neighbor. And his mother refused to have him lifted. And some of the kids and indeed parents are very snobby towards him, and indeed very snobby towards Clara, that he shouldn't be there. And to me, it was a great commentary on social and educational inequality. Mm. And it really reminded me, as a sort of, I may not cut this out, but as a very, I grew up incredibly poor child of first generation immigrants, but I somehow got a scholarship to a very good private school. And so my birthday parties would be all my sort of school friends who were all way richer than me, which was already very nervous making because they had to come to my house, which was horrible, right? Relative to theirs. Although very loving and cool. I mean, I loved it, right? But so I was very on edge socially. And then there would always be one or two cousins my age who would come, who were in state public schools, who would come. And they would, again, stick out like a sore thumb because the accent was totally different. The clothes were totally different. And they would be condescended to in the same way. So I found the minute social observations of that party to be so, so true. And the way Clara, as the AF, observes Josie's personality or her behavior change when she's around the other lifted children, to me seemed very much like if an AF had seen me with my family and then at a birthday party with all of my private school friends, it would have been that damning. I mean, Clara is never damning. She's very empathetic, but it does make her uneasy. And she's worried for Josie about the changes in her. And she's worried for Josie's friendship with her childhood best friend because of this. So well observed. And I was just thinking of Kazuo Ishiguro as a guy who grew up in Japan in this very class graded society and then came to England and went through the same kind of schooling I did as an immigrant, just like living life in these societies that are so coded, being such a good observer of this awkwardness. And I was wondering how you found that. Why would I presume to know? Like, would this resonate to an American? It always felt to me like in America, the school system is much more egalitarian, but maybe it isn't. Or that class stuff is less pointed, but maybe it isn't. I don't know.
Well, I'll just say for me, I also went to a private school and it had that same situation where there was just a significant inequality of where a great majority of people were coming from. And it was that same feeling where, like, you had that need to sort of code switch in certain situations and it just, you just felt like you had to do it. And that's kind of like what I think Josie feels like in this situation that you're describing. And you just don't, you start to feel like you're not who you are in a lot of situations. And I think that the fact that Clara is able to recognize that, we can see again that more clearly if Josie maybe was not able to see that in herself at the time. And I think that the element of being lifted, I'm not like, I'm curious what you think about this, because I'm not sure if that in a way levels the playing field more, or if it exacerbates and increases the feeling of inequality, the feeling of some people having and some people having not. Just like what that would do, like for imagining that scenario where everyone could get this. Well, I guess the question, right, is could everyone get, but if some people had access to this idea of gene editing and to actually have like a built-in advantage in that way, like what would that do? How would that change society? Or would it just exacerbate the issues we already have?
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because Ish doesn't specify whether the lifting costs money, or is this something the state offers everyone and some parents refuse it because of the risk? And if you were the child of non-lifted people, would you be offered lifting? I guess we don't know, because I think this is the first generation who's being offered it, right? The parents were not lifted, but both of Josie's parents are very clearly white collar workers. Maybe it's because I just watched the Netflix college admissions documentary, which I thought was very good. Mm-hmm. To me, this just seemed like the logical extensions. I mean, if you have these very rich parents right now, and actually, if you watch the WeWork documentary, which is also very good, and you read that Adam Neumann's wife founded a prep school in New York that was going to charge, you know, like $35,000 a year for like 7-year-olds to make paintings. To me, it seemed like the logical extension of that. You know, people do whatever they can to create an advantage for their children. Like it's a meritocracy in theory, but if you can use your wealth to make sure they have the best school, if you can get them into the right university, because you think that then guarantees them the good job and wealth that is perpetuated, you could absolutely see certain types of parents doing the gene editing to make sure they were just that little bit smarter. It's clever of Ish not to say whether it's monetary, but, and maybe I'm, what did you think? Because I think maybe I brought that to it. The idea that this was only going to be affordable by certain types of people, just like only certain types of people can afford to buy artificial friends.
I think there is one moment in the novel where that point is made when discussing at some point, I think, about whether or not Rick was going to be lifted. I think there was a mention of that it does have a cost associated to it, so there would be that barrier. I agree with you, this idea that like it's actually not that different from how things are now, where some people just have those advantages, have those opportunities that others don't just because of money. Like that just is a thing objectively. So I guess like the question is like, would a threshold be crossed if that was built into the DNA where you could say, because I have money, I am able to predispose my kid to just be smarter and to have even more opportunity? Because I think like the one moderating factor where things are now is like, there is a situation where you don't have as much money, but you have some level of intelligence and you work your ass off and you're able to get that position that other person wasn't. And would that be taken away if just the rich kids were just smarter? Like that, it would just exacerbate again.
But that's the difference, isn't it? I mean, ultimately, you have to assume there's a normal distribution of smarts versus stupidity in poor kids and rich kids.
Right.
And there are, you know, obviously by far not enough, but there are mechanisms by which people like me would like get a scholarship or somehow, you know, get that kind of teaching that would allow me to fulfill my potential. And I'm sure many people, both rich and poor, don't have that. And that's very unfortunate, but obviously it's more poor people than rich people. But ultimately, the peak of the normal distribution of smartness isn't different from the poor and rich kid. But I think what the gene editing means is that if I hadn't been able to get a scholarship to get my genes edited, I'm going to be maybe, 250% stupider than the lifted kid. I don't know what that ratio is, but to me, it felt like there was a gulf that couldn't be breached. I mean, you get the impression with Rick, whose mum has chosen for him not to be lifted, who's super smart, right? But it's just a gulf that is going to be too big to traverse. Now, is that social snobbery or is that real and based on intelligence? I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm sort of imagining like the super utilitarian sort of survival of the fittest scenario where like, all right, we lift X amount of kids and they're the only ones who have opportunities in life. And we kind of see this clearly in the narrative, especially through Josie's father, where he was a person who had a job and he lost it. We can get into that more later. But like, so we lift the kids, they have the opportunities, their kids are lifted. And like eventually society reaches a point where everyone is lifted and like everyone gets opportunities. But of course that wouldn't happen, right? Like somehow they would create more social divides. I think it's inevitable in some way that people would find a way to create these divides. And it's unfortunate, but it kind of seems to be how we work as humans. We find ways to set some people above others. We create those situations where that's possible.
Just be another plane to compete on. I always remember reading, I was fascinated by Lance Armstrong. I still am. And, if you read interviews with him and watch that famous Oprah interview, like he just felt if everyone's doping, I'm going to do it better. I'm just going to be better at it. It just created, like you could say the entire Tour de France was effectively lifted by doping, right? I mean, very few people in it were clean, but it became another plane to compete on. So I think what's interesting with the lifting thing is if we ever got a sequel, do people within the lifted world then start sort of hyper competing and on what plane? For those minimal jobs that actually still exist, right? So
yeah, I mean, the Frank situation is, and it feels this way when you read the novel, it's a scary reality to look at. And part of the reason for that is because I don't think it's so far away, this notion of gene
CRISPR
editing.
CRISPR is here, right? So if you're gonna use CRISPR to get rid of the diabetes gene or whatever it is, why would you not use it?
But also
there are gonna be rich people who are doing this in our lifetime and probably in the next decade, right? I mean,
absolutely, yeah. But the other thing too is that when you look at it this way, in this stark way where you literally are going on a gene level to give people advantages. It just makes us confront the reality that we already live in now in a more clear way that, yes, some people do have advantages in life and life is not fair. And it feels uncomfortable to look that in the face. And I think that, to me, I've always said this, I say this a lot, like that is the power of science fiction, to make us look at something as this sort of dark, distorted mirror of what our reality currently is. And
yeah. So in which case, then maybe this isn't a sci-fi book at all, right? It's just another way of looking at our current reality.
Sure,
yeah. I thought that very much with the story of Rick and his mum, who tries to use an old, maybe college boyfriend, or, you know, an old boyfriend of old who she had rejected, who's now very powerful and on the admissions committee for the one university that will still take unlifted kids. And she tries to pull in favors to get Rick admitted, despite the fact that he's not lifted, and very explicitly says, you know, of course we're asking him for a favor in the heated moment of this sort of meeting. And I thought, this is exactly it, right? Like, we're all trying to play our advantages. Like, this is nothing different to now that if you came from a slightly worse school, but if you happen to have a cousin's uncle who was on this board, of course you would make that phone call for your child. And is that, I mean, isn't that just parents being parents? I don't know. I have so many conflicts on this, and I'm sort of vaguely involved in admissions at Oxford. And, you know, you do get those phone calls through. He didn't go to a good school. It was a state school. Will you help? And you just sort of think, yeah, it's so tricky. I love it, though. I think this is so, it's so our current world.
Right, exactly. It resonates with us in a very clear way, because we live this, you know. This is just what the situation is. And the optimistic view would be, okay, we can rise above this. But I think when the novel presents it this way, you see, actually, no, it's just going to get worse. I think we just, I mean, I acknowledge that potentially is a very plausible reality, is something.
Yeah,
a lot of stuff here.
So the next topic I'd put down, and I find this so fascinating as an economist, because, you know, we spend endless amount of time, I would say 50% of the papers I read right now coming out of academic macroeconomic research are on, you know, structural bond yields and inflation and the rise of inflation potentially now and how we get out of all this quantitative easing. The other 50% are all on what happens when, you know, how all the blue collar workers lost their jobs in the like 80s and 90s, and we ended up with opioid crises and people who were left behind and became angry, and we like called them patronizing names and despicables and deplorables or whatever. But hey, now advanced robotics and AI is coming after our jobs as white collar workers and the, you know, the intellect economy. Oh shit, maybe we better come up with a solution now because it's coming for us. So all those, that 50% of papers are all about things like universal basic income and all the stuff Andrew Yang talks about, which I think is really awesome that politicians are finally grappling with it. So we have this in this world. So the white collar workers are being, the word is substituted in this world. And some of them choose to carry on working, like Josie's mum, even though it's basically futile. And others,
and
like,
she's working intensely to just keep up.
Yeah, exactly, which is so soul-destroying. And then others, like Josie's father, may have resisted at first. He's an engineer, I believe. But then, this is the kind of weird thing, like, Ish doesn't really talk about UBI. He talks about those people going to communities where they will be happy, they'll resettle and learn that life can be valuable and full without work. But in those communities, people have kind of stratified themselves. So the engineers maybe stick with the engineers, and the other workers, the blue collar workers, maybe stick with the blue collar workers. And we don't want their sort, in inverted commas, coming in with our sort. And there are hints that Josie's dad has a little bit of a sort of violent proto-fascist sort of, we will protect with guns what is ours kind of attitude about him. How did you find that as a response to automation? Because I've seen so many things about UBI and stuff that are very economic, but this kind of very almost like visceral social response I found really unique and interesting.
Well, it's definitely a question I wanted to see addressed, right? So like, what happens when people get replaced? Where do those people go? Where do they end up? And it wasn't the answer I expected, which I liked, which is the idea that they would form into these sort of independent states, it felt like. Like, each of these little communities are their own sort of like rebel state, it felt like, from whatever the larger apparatus is. Like, they've created their own form of government, their own way of operating, and they've apparently, like, at least in the case of Josie's father, they've armed themselves to defend whatever their new beliefs are. So that is the one of the many consequences of creating the situation where you take away the life that people had, they will find a new life for themselves, and they may want to defend it in a way that could create issues for your own state. So I think that was interesting. And I again, like, it's one of those things where I appreciate how it was introduced but not like expounded upon and made its own narrative. Like we can ask and answer those questions in our own head about what that might be like and what that's going to lead to, but we don't need the story to do that for us, because the story isn't really about that. It's just an element that we can ruminate on and just adds another layer of intrigue and curiosity to the world that we have here.
And what's really interesting is Ish has that discipline that the POV is so strictly on Josie. We meet her when she's born and switched on in the store. We see her as, Clara, we see her as Josie's friend. When Josie goes to college and has no need for her, and we see effectively her put out to pasture in a knacker's yard, as we'd say in England, like in a yard, as her mental faculties are maybe fading and her body is fading. And it goes. And anything that isn't strictly Clara's point of view and story is not explored. So we have this tantalizing thing about the dad, but if it's not a conversation that is overheard between the mum and the dad, then we're not going to explore that. And I find that fascinating, but I really want to read Ish's novel about what happens to people, because I really strongly feel this is going to be me in about 15 years time.
Again, it's one of those things that's disturbingly plausible that this could happen. And I specifically that element, I had never thought of this idea that people would form their own states. Again, like, it makes so much sense. So again, it's just a clever world building element that we get just enough of that we can talk about it in this way where we can see the full picture of it so clearly.
And what I wrote here is proto-fascism in identitarian communities. Yeah. What I found interesting is when we talk about sort of identitarian politics or identity, a lot of it's along the lines of, you know, sex or gender or sexuality or race or whatever that may be. But actually, if you think about how you live your life, a lot of it, if you are of working age and in a career, is about your identity as a doctor, as an economist, or as whatever it is that you happen to do for a living. And the idea that when society goes through this very kind of radical change, the one thing that you might want to cling to and it gives you meaning in yourself is not the fact that I happen to be a brown woman, but the fact that I am a financial worker, I'm an economist, and I might want to hang out with those people and almost replicate the office environment, right? We no longer have work to do, but we all kind of speak the same language, we kind of have the same memories. That kind of office banter, how we were together, that kind of collegial feeling. Maybe that's what I want to live in and take forward, rather than just picking people who happen to be, you know, Asian women or whatever it may be. I thought that was really radical. Like, my God, what would I most strongly identify with? Mm-hmm. What would I want to keep and nurture and keep, you know, take forward with me?
And what happens when the rest of society rejects your ability to do that job? Like, you're no longer relevant. Is that, like, how does that sort of radicalize your view of what you do, and how are you able to hang on to that? I feel like in a way you would become more desperate if you were in that situation to hold on to that in a way that may not actually result in the thing that you were doing in such, I don't know, like, it's so hard to picture, like, what you would do in a world where you are trained and you have spent your life, like, on this one thing, and the world says, no, we actually don't need you to do that anymore. Like, how do you keep that alive? I would be desperate to find ways to hang on to it. Because that's my life, you know, that's the most important thing. That's the thing that I've spent my life cultivating, but the world doesn't want it anymore. Like, it would be tough. And I think you would take those radical choices, like we see with the dad.
I see it all the time in sort of late 50s and early 60-year-old colleagues who have more than made enough wealth to live very comfortably. Right. And they will not retire because this is what they know. It's where they value themselves. They need to feel that they're in it. I always say to people, if I won the lottery tomorrow, I would give up work in a nanosecond and go off and do PhDs in German literature and read lots of cool books and, you know, travel the world. But would you really? And maybe it's the sense of volition. Like, if you choose to renounce your career because you want to do other things, it's one thing. If you're told you cannot do it, because, by the way, there's an artificial economist who can do it so much better.
Yeah.
In fact, there probably already is, right? There's probably AIs who can sort of machine learn and read data and make predictions better than me right now.
Right.
So I definitely think this, I mean, I constantly have the prayer that I just get another 10, 15 years out of my career before I'm functionally obsolete. It's just an interesting thing about volition and when it happens to you. I find this fascinating, but this isn't really the core of the book, it's fair to say to people listening.
Yeah. I think I just want to say one more thing on it. I think the father is such an interesting character to explore that. And we hear him make the point that he has like discovered other meanings in life, like beyond
joining a militia.
He does not net structure in life anymore. Like he has found another purpose that is more fulfilling to him. And of course, and that's what's cool about it, right? Is it's not a yes, no, this is right, this is the wrong thing, but his is actually not the way to live, like living in the sort of like, I mean, could just strictly, and obviously that is not a definitive thing. It might just be him. Like, sure.
If you think of capitalism as, you know, you have the division between labor and capital, and we're basically saying that has gone, and their capital is totally different. Yeah, then happens, right? I mean, this is the kind of the Marxist utopia in a way, sort of work is competed away at some point and we all have leisure time.
Yeah, but what do we do with it? You know, this thing, it's scary.
Yeah. I mean, what did all those gentlemen of leisure do? And what we have yet to discuss is really this idea that Josie's mother has already lost her elder child to a mother in mourning. Book is sick. And it's not clear she's going to pull Josie through it. And the dad maybe disagreed is maybe what broke them up. And the mother has therefore taken to have Josie's portrait painted, but it's not really a portrait painting. What she's actually doing is creating an artificial friend body that looks exactly like Josie. And she's asking Clara to observe Josie minutely so that Clara could play act as Josie in the Josie body and the mother could hopefully transfer her love to fake Josie if Josie died. And there's a long, I guess, dialogue in this book between the mother, between the guy making the body and between the father about whether this will work. So the guy creating the body says, you know, we've been under this illusion that people are unique. And you fall in love with someone and they die and that's heartbreaking. But actually, no one's unique. They're just a digital record and we can reconstruct them in a new body and your love can continue. Whereas the father, I guess, and maybe ultimately Josie's mum, come to believe that that's not right. And even if you had the perfect replicant, it wouldn't be the same. So it really, this is a book about what is the nature of, what do you love? What is that thing that you're loving? And can it be facsimile copied and put in another person and the love can continue? How did you respond to that part of the novel, Zach?
Well, I think the book itself seems to, at the end, reject the idea that that is possible. I think Clara herself acknowledges that at one point, where no matter how good she is, no matter how capable and observant she is, and no matter how well she understands Josie, it just simply would not work. Like, it just, no matter how well she operated as a facsimile, there would always be something there where the mother would never be able to see her as Josie. There's something missing that just wouldn't be. And I think I tend to agree with that. But again, like I wonder about it, right? Because I think there is something to what the AF scientist guy, I can't remember his name, was saying. Like, I think there is something there. And I think maybe the hidden element, like, right, would be like, what if you wiped the memory of knowing that your actual child died? And then like you were able to like convincing, like in some way remove those memories and know, and or just think that this was them the whole time. Would that work? I think that might work.
What do you think? Because I think it's the knowledge that this isn't the person.
Yeah, exactly. It's just the knowledge.
Prevents it. So I think what's really fascinating, if people are into this, is there's an amazing, really low budget indie movie called Marjorie Prime that stars John Hamm, actually. And it's about an old woman who is losing her memory a little bit. And you can buy effectively an artificial friend, but you can program it to be like her deceased husband. And through his memories shared with her, maybe that will keep her mind active. So this idea, again, that if you didn't know that you'd lost, if your memory was that you hadn't lost the husband, would you be convinced by it? And if you thought of yourself because of dementia as a young girl and you had a young John Hamm as your husband, would you live a very happy life in your mind? So if you're interested in all these topics, listener, I would strongly recommend checking out Marjorie Prime. It's a really fascinating, very low budget, very relationship heavy sci-fi movie, I guess, but really focuses on all these questions. I think you're right, Zach. I think maybe the novel comes down on one side, but I think there is this lingering fear that maybe the portrait painter was right and we're not meaning culture.
Yeah, it's just that element of memory is the key, I think, right? Like just the knowing that this is a different person. You can't escape that unless you were able to remove that. So yeah, that is the piece that I think matters. I don't think it's something intrinsic about a particular person and their soul necessarily, but maybe it is. I don't claim to know. That's just how I would view that particular thing. And
does
I appreciate
digital transfer make love obsolete?
Right. Yeah. Like you were talking there also about the idea of like making the choice. I think this is a level of complexity that I liked a lot about the idea of lifting is like it's not an easy choice where in some cases if you had the money, it would be obvious, right? Where you just give them the advantage. But in this world, there are risks, like you said. You could die very easily. It has this risk of side effects where you could get very ill. And Josie, that almost happens to, and to her sister, it does happen to. So like, how does that affect the choice as a parent, right? Like, how do you make that call? That is so much a question in the novel. Like, are
and
you
that's
willing?
Why I think that difference on the normal distribution between non-lifted and lifted must be very great, because otherwise it wouldn't be worth the risk. If a child can potentially die, the payoff has to be high enough.
Right.
In terms of their quality of life and opportunities that you would be willing to do it, especially as we know, you know, Josie's mum, all the characters are basically quite sympathetic. You know, Josie's mum's already lost a child, so she full well knows the risks involved, but she's still willing to do it. So society at this point must be very messed up that seems like a valid, you know, chance to take.
Exactly. I was going to say that exact thing. Like, that's what the value of Rick really is as a character, to see like what happens when you don't do that. Like, what are the consequences of that choice? And that is the thing that his mother wrestles with, the idea of, and she constantly is trying to make up for that choice. That's the whole thing with trying to get in with the one school that will accept him and doing anything she can, to the point of like dredging up this very toxic, evidently, relationship with this ex-lover to try to make it happen. Like, and the book kind of leaves Rick, it feels, pretty optimistically about where his life might go. But I think, like, at least how I believe it, he's going to have a lot of struggle in his life, a lot more than Josie probably will have. And so we see the consequences, I think, for him too, where his life is just not going to be the same as hers. And I think he's going to probably end up in one of these communities, probably, or something like that.
And ultimately, they're not going to be together. And it's such a beautiful friendship, childhood love, when they're drawing those little, she draws little cartoons and he fills in the speech bubbles. And that's how they communicate their most troubling, strange thoughts. And it's a shame to know that ultimately love isn't everything, right? It's not going to be strong enough to cross this class divide, which is, I think, Ish being very realistic in his novels, as always, a bit like, who am I thinking of? Ish always reminds me of, who wrote Room with a View? E.M. Forster.
Okay.
A century ago. E.M. Forster, the nonpareil English writer, about love across class boundaries, and it just doesn't typically work, which is quite manly.
And that's something I appreciated most, and it's such a hard thing to pull off, I think, that what this novel does is there are no neat happy endings, but at the same time, you never feel like the characters had bad endings. Like, there's just that uncertainty that I think is life, right? Like, you're constantly trying to be optimistic that the next thing will be good, but you never really know. There's no clear structure of how things are going to go for you. And even like with Clara, like, she ends up in a scrap heap at the end of the novel, right?
But
like,
she's happy, isn't she?
Exactly. It has that element to it, like, right? It's not just pure sad drudgery for Clara, who got scrapped after she served her purpose. She finds a way to be optimistic about it. So when you read it, you don't feel that bad for her. It's such an interesting way to balance that, where she ends up in a situation that we would commonly see as like, oh, that sucks, right? Like, Clara's in a junkyard, but it doesn't feel that way, which I think is something special.
What I find Ish is very good on is the concept of service. And I think maybe people who don't like him because they find this literally incredible. They don't believe someone can be like this, that a life of service can be that fulfilling. They find it kind of pastiche, or like Downton Abbey, just like really unrealistic. But, you know, in this novel, he creates a character who really has great satisfaction from effectively martyrdom, right? I mean, she gives up her peg 2 fluid or whatever to destroy the Cootings machine. In a way, I'm not going to spoil the books, but if you get to Remains of the Day, that's very famously about a long-serving butler who is in service to a British aristocrat during sort of like the run up to World War II. And again, I think people find it very hard to swallow that character because it's almost like this masochistic sense of service, and you wonder, in service to what ultimately? But he finds great satisfaction from it. And it's a very old fashioned thing, I think. I've been thinking about it a lot with sad passing of His Royal Highness Prince Philip, that a life of service is kind of a very old-fashioned concept, because we live in a much more sort of individualistic, self-actuating kind of world now, which is kind of good. But yeah, it's still valid. I think what Ish is trying to say is it's a valid choice and it can still make you happy, which I find kind of provocative, maybe, all on its own.
Well, yeah, it's provocative because I think we don't want to acknowledge that that can be very fulfilling and be very purposeful. But I think we do on an emotional level, because for us, like, this book resonates with us. The journey of Clara resonates with us. But also, like, I mean, like, Sam is like everyone's favorite character in Lord of the Rings, and he is a servant, right? So clearly there's something about that life that resonates with us. So yeah, it's something that we might not want to acknowledge. But yeah, I think there is something to that.
Although I'm wondering if Frodo ever treated Sam as bad as when a grown up, healthy Josie kind of comes to visit Clara in the utility room.
And Sam didn't get thrown in the scrap. He got to come over to the
and then realizes that poor Clara loved the sun, so it can create some boxes for her to stand on, but never thinks of actually taking her out of
It's a little. Yeah, Sam's got a little bit better than Clara, that's for sure. Yeah, there's an element too. I mean, this idea of AI, right? Like, AI are essentially slaves. They don't get anything. They're just there to serve. And so that is that other pernicious element too. Where, yeah, like, what is this? What is the reality, the future of this? And are we going to accept it? Because we don't view AIs as human. So it's okay to indenture them in a way where they never, you know, they never get out, and we just throw them away when we're done with them.
And that comes up at the party, right? Where some of the kids want to sort of throw
Clara. Yeah, they just want to toss her around, yeah.
And Josie intervenes, but it is very touch and go how that scene is going to play out. And you get even in the store manager who goes to find Clara on the scrap heap, you get the feeling that she is concerned that her AFs find good owners, because presumably there are horror stories out there that we never truly hear about of things not going well.
I'm sure, yeah. I'm sure it's really disturbing just to imagine, like, the edges of the story where that kind of stuff is happening, because we see the seeds of it. And we're lucky that Clara did end up with, like, a family that at least, like, tries to treat her like a person at times. But even then, there are many moments where she just has to stand in the corner or whatever. Like, she just has to be the robot. It's such a tricky,
the whole concept thing of Josie's mom saying you have to give up your personality.
Yeah, like, you need to be Josie now. Like, you are not a person.
I mean, that's very, very messed up. I mean,
yeah, it's crazy.
And
yeah,
in a way, it's more violently. Well, is it more? I don't know. I don't want to make an equivalence, but the standard sci-fi trope, I'm thinking of Battlestar Galactica, is, you know, the classic, if you rape the AI, is that really rape? I think this is almost as bad, but different, because it's just saying, erase yourself.
Yeah, fully erasing this person.
You're of such little value to me. You can just become a vessel for my kid. Anything else you want to discuss? I mean, I would say, like, thematically, people should, if they love this, read Remains of the Day or Never Let Me Go, both of which a little bit are about, well, Remains of the Day about being a servant, Never Let Me Go about the child POV, early love, sacrifice. All those themes come into it. But anything else on Clara?
No, I think we hit most of the things I was looking to talk about. Yeah, I'm just happy this book exists for a lot of reasons. Like, yeah. For me, like, of course, an access point for me were these sort of questions we're talking about, where it's these sort of interesting, like, near future realities we may have to confront. And I find all that so compelling on its own. That's one of the main reasons why I enjoy science fiction, is that sort of dark mirror where you can look at these things that are a little too true that we don't want to look at, but also just the characters and the situation. And Clara, again, Clara was such a great POV. So much fun to read how she looked at the world. Enjoyed it so much. And I'm also just happy because, like, this is such an easy book to recommend. You know, I'm sure you have the situation where, like, you want to recommend people books, but it's like, you don't want to recommend them, like, a series or a thing that's hard to get into, or, like, a thing that's kind of difficult to grasp. But, like, it's so nice to have another book in your arsenal where you can be like, this is just a great book.
you should read this. And honestly, I've got friends of all types and interests and readers, non-readers, and the reception has been really warm from all of them. So I have no problem recommending it. It is going to become a film currently. Sony Pictures bought the rights. The person writing it is a woman called Darby Waller, who I think wrote or directed parts of Mad Men. She has a really good, oh, and Mrs. America, so a really good sort of mini series background. But this is going to be a feature film. Any views on which format or agnostic?
To me, a film makes the most sense just from a structural point of view. I don't think there's enough it would certainly feel padded, even as a miniseries, I think, to like, what would be like the 6 episodes of this? Like, I just don't think
they'd have to broaden it out, right? They'd have to show you the dad's community.
Yeah, and maybe that's fine. Maybe that's the way to make an adaptation feel like its own thing, because I do think there would struggle here, because so much of the book is Clara's interiority and being like, that is like 90% of what makes it good. So like, that would be the struggle with an adaptation. So maybe they'd have to lean on other elements to make it really good. And of course, like, a really good performance could give us some access to that from whoever played her. But I think this is the idealized, as it tends to be, the original is the idealized form of how this story could be told. But I'd check it out, certainly, if there was an adaptation of this.
Cool. Well, it was so much fun talking about this with you, Zach, partly because we haven't spoken in so long, and this is such an amazing piece of work to discuss. So thank you so, so much. I think it's the kind of book that you put it down and immediately you're like, okay, who else is out there? I need to talk this through.
Absolutely.
Really hope you all listening either have read it, share your thoughts with us, come and join Vassals of Kingsgrave on the Discord server. You can find where that is, get a link to it on our Twitter feed and on the podcast device and Fire forums if they're up. It's just a book that deserves to be cherished and discussed and debated. So thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. Bye, everyone. Bye-bye.